Welcome to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. And today on the program, we've got Obama's executive actions, the Oregon standoff, Salt Lake City's new mayor, and much more. And joining me this morning in studio is Tribune environmental reporter Emma Penrod. Emma, welcome back.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Also with us, Tribune City Hall reporter Christopher Smart. Hi, Chris.
Good morning.
Religion writer Peggy Fletcher Stack is here as well. Peggy, welcome.
Thank you. Hello.
And joining us by phone is Washington correspondent and newly elected National Press Club president Thomas Burr. Hi, Tommy.
Hey, thanks for the plug.
You're welcome. And our audience, you are welcome to join us too. What headlines caught your eye this week? You can put comments online, sltrib.com. You can also tweet to the hashtag TribTalk, or you can call us. 801-355-TALK is that number. 801-355-8255. We're a week into an armed takeover of a federal wildlife refuge in Oregon. And this morning, Christopher Smart, you're reporting that a delegation from Utah is headed there to see if they can peacefully resolve the situation. Who are these folks, Chris?
Well, it's largely a group of Utahns. They are being led up by political activist Steve Maxfield and a Kanawha attorney named Todd McFarlane. McFarlane has been called upon to represent one of the protesters up there, Lavoy Finicum, who is actually a rancher from northern Arizona and a compatriot with Ammon Bundy and Clive Bundy. So as this Utah group was watching the coverage up there, they got the sinking sensation that the protesters were not looking very good on TV. And so their mission was to go up there and see if they could help them better articulate what they're after and perhaps diffuse the situation a little bit.
Were they invited or are they going of their own accord?
They're just going of their own accord. This is sort of this group, this ad hoc group of like-minded folks, including Janely Tobias, who is a community activist and a gun rights activist. But they believe that statements made by Lavoy Finicum, that he would rather die than go to jail, set
this. And he's one of the protesters in
Oregon.
He's
one of the protesters, and his family retained Todd McFarlane to go up there and see if they couldn't get these guys out of what's more and more looking like a jam, and it's looking like they're not getting their message across. And for anybody who's never been to one of these, I call them media circuses, but they're these national stories where all the media, national and international media, come and you've got a dozen satellite trucks and dozens of reporters and cameramen. You get a soundbite to tell your story. And Ammon Bundy, who's the spokesman, is apparently not well schooled in this, as most folks aren't. So it's on the media end of things, they're really losing.
Okay. Do you know if they've had contact with the group of protesters? Do the protesters know that they're coming? And will they be able to get to the refuge, because there is sort of a barricade, isn't there?
No, I think you can drive right on. And yes, this group has been in contact. They know these folks personally. They're part of this loosely knit group who are seeking changes in management of federal lands. So they know them, and they're friendly with them. They're on good terms with them. So they believe that they can go up there and sort of help them understand that their message isn't getting across. I think that's a polite way of saying it. But they, you know, I think at this point, the protesters are not going to leave until they get something so that they can save face. They need a little something from the authorities so that they can say, well, we've proven our point and we're going home.
Now, members of this armed protest group include Ammon Bundy, as you mentioned, his brother Ryan. They are sons of the Nevada rancher who held an armed protest over grazing rights. I think it was 2014. They're protesting what they see as federal overreach. But in the process, they've cited LDS scripture and their Mormon beliefs to justify the actions. And Peggy, how has Mormonism been injected into this situation?
Yes, they have cited their beliefs. They have said, Ammon Bundy has said he was inspired by God to do this. And one of the protesters called himself Captain Moroni, which is the name of a figure in the Book of Mormon, which is the LDS Church's unique scripture.
Who was Captain Moroni?
Captain Moroni was, a figure in the Book of Mormon who led an army in terms of freedom and that sort of thing.
So these beliefs by the protesters that God is supporting their actions, that actually prompted LDS officials to issue a statement this week. What did they say?
They came out and, quote, strongly condemned the armed seizure of the facility, which is quite rare for the LDS Church to do, to issue a statement like that about some of its members' actions. So it was pretty strong.
Do you think the message got through to the protesters? Have their citations of scripture diminished since that statement came out?
I actually have no idea.
Well, let's talk about other reaction, because this situation has pretty much everyone weighing in. And Tommy Burr, you're reporting that the Utah congressional delegation, they're sympathetic, even if they don't agree with this method of protest.
Sure. And you know, I think that's to be expected in some way. As we know, the Utah delegation is fully Republican now. And members like Rob Bishop have been, you know, fighting for years, saying that the federal government doesn't manage the public lands well and has closed off too much to the public and really is trying to, you know, keep people from, you know, activities on public lands that they've been doing for generations. So when I talked to them, I wasn't really surprised to see that they say, you know, they really feel and understand the frustration that these guys have with the federal government and the, you know, quote unquote overreach they have there. But the, you know, the delegation also is smart enough to know that this is not the way to get about it. You don't take over a federal building as part of a protest. You know, you wave some signs or have a rally or something like that. Taking over a federal government building, as Senator Mike Lee told my colleague Matt Canham, you know, he expects federal charges, criminal charges in this respect. And the federal government really, though, it seems, gets it so far. They're not really running in there with, an armed force to take over, take the building back, because that just would escalate the situation. It's the middle of winter. It's January. It's a small little building. They can let those guys wait there until they run out of food if they want to. Hmm.
You mentioned that Rob Bishop has really been at the center of this public lands debate, and that seems to be the core argument for these protesters. Has anyone, Bishop or anyone else in the delegation, offered to facilitate a resolution?
Not necessarily yet. I know Congressman Chaffetz, when I talked to him, said that his door is open to these guys if they want to come in and chat with him about their concerns with this. Rob Bishop says he's going to have hearings on this issue, not necessarily about, you know, the Oregon standoff and the Hammond brothers that this is all kind of coming around, focusing on, but on the issue of, you know, land managers and how they treat the residents of the areas where these preservation, these refuges are. However, there is now a bill in Congress, Congressman Raul Grijalva, the top Democrat on the House Natural Resources Committee, introduced a legislation to try to get the sense of Congress that this is not the right way to go about it. In a Republican Congress, I highly doubt that bill is going to see the light of day, but at least, you know, there's a message there somewhere. Mm.
Peggy, the protesters, the church response, what's your sense of the ability of the church to discipline these folks? That seems to have been a topic, at least on social media. A lot of people arguing that the church should intervene in a stronger way.
Yeah, I've read that too. people calling for them to be disciplined, as some people on the left have. But I'm just speculating here, but I don't think that that's what the church is inclined to do. Those disciplinary actions are all prompted locally. So if the Bundy's local leaders feel that they've done something in error, then they might take action. But I highly doubt it.
We saw this week that a public meeting drew hundreds in Burns County. The sheriff met with the Bundy group yesterday, asking them to leave. He offered to ensure their safe passage out of the county. The offer was declined. I mean, so, Chris, again, what makes this Utah group think that they can negotiate an end to this occupation?
Okay, so it's a Utah group that has gone up there, but this is sort of a Western states phenomenon where the ranchers and their political supporters have for years complained about the way that federal lands are managed, and it's hard to know exactly. I mean, Clive and Bundy didn't want to pay his the lease on the public land where he grazes his cattle. So, you know, does he want to graze his cattle for free? I don't know. There's a Republican Congress that could do something, and I don't know what, because it's unclear exactly what this group wants. They haven't spelled it out. I mean, they say things like, well, we want our country back and those sorts of things, but I don't know of any specifics. But I do know that it is a Western states phenomenon. However, up there in Eastern Oregon, the folks around there don't want these people there. They're not from the area. They don't think they're helping them out. This stems from the conviction of two ranchers up there, the Hammonds, who were convicted of setting fires on public lands. They got sentences, but then those sentences were reviewed and actually made longer recently. And those two have reported to prison to serve out five-year sentences, and they said that they do not support Bundy's group. And really, the locals there just want Bundy's group to leave.
Well, it'll be very interesting to see if the Utah group can make some headway in that regard. Before we head to a break, I want to talk about the big story this week nationally. President Obama making a unilateral decision to act on curbing gun violence. And Tommy, you were at the White House for the announcement. Outline what the president's executive orders do.
Sure, there's several things they do. The biggest one, of course, that people are paying attention to is the expanded background checks. So right now, if you want to sell a gun, if I'm going to sell a gun to my friend Chris, who's on your show right now, I can do so without having to do a background check on Chris, and I don't have to report that. I don't have a federal license. What the president's executive order says is it doesn't necessarily have any kind of a line of where you have to start reporting to the federal government, getting a license, doing background checks. But if you are a private seller and you sell over the internet, 7 guns a year, 12 guns a year, or you go to a gun show and you sell 20 guns during a year, that might trigger the fact that you have to now get a license. You have to do the background checks. Essentially, what the president did was take a small step towards what he's been hoping Congress would do in the last 5 years or more, and obviously Congress hasn't done anything. Beyond that, the president also is requesting more money to continually update and make sure it's always up to date, the mental health database that the states give to the federal government for those background checks, as well as add in more FBI examiners for the background checks to expedite those and make them more thorough.
A Utah woman stood behind the president as he unveiled these proposals, I guess these actions. Tell us about Carolyn Tuft.
Carolyn Tuft, you know, it's always difficult to talk to a victim of gun violence, and it was no different with Carolyn Tuft. She was at Trolley Square in 2007 with her daughter, actually shopping for Valentine's Day cards, I believe. And that's when that shooting happened at Trolley Square shopping mall. The gunman came in, shot her daughter, left the store, and then came back, shot her again, and then shot and killed her daughter. So she was shot three times. Her daughter was killed instantly on the spot in a little card store at Trolley Square. And she's become since. In fact, she talked this week on Trig Talk about how she really didn't pay attention to gun laws before, but has since become a very big gun control advocate. And she was saying, you know, it's about time. It's long overdue that the president acted, that Congress needs to finally step up and do something, and that they need to go further. That what the president did isn't enough.
She certainly supports the measure. The public in Utah apparently agrees with her, according to a new poll.
You're right. The Utah policy came out of the poll. They actually did the poll in December, so this is not necessarily about the actions that the president took this week. But the poll showed 76% of Utahns support expanded background checks. And that really pairs right on target with national polls that have shown Americans for more than a decade have supported expanded background checks. Honestly, there's a very small minority in the polls that say they don't want more research and background checks into people buying guns. And that poll in Utah, by the way, I should note, a large majority of Republicans backed that. This wasn't just independents and Democrats. This was Republicans as well.
Well, Republican leaders certainly do not agree with the executive orders, or at least they don't agree with the way the president did it. The president, they say, should not have acted on his own. Can you tell us how Utah's delegation is responding?
You're right. And it was really the delegation was concerned about the process. They obviously, most of them haven't voted for, you know, expanded background checks in the past. But really, it was the process they're concerned about. That, again, it's another Obama executive order. It's unilateral action that he shouldn't be making law. He's not the king. That's what Congress is there for. So they were very careful in their responses about how it's the process and not necessarily the substance of the executive orders.
So how are these executive orders going to affect gun control legislation or, I suppose, the 2016 presidential race?
Well, that's really the goal, I think, here in many ways. The president's doing a State of the Union next week. And I think for the most part, the president's really kind of set an agenda item. He really wants gun control to be part of the 2016 debate. He wants to bring it up in an election year so that Congress has to think about it, or at least there has to be some kind of vote on this issue to make it an election issue. You know, these executive orders are undoubtedly going to be challenged in court, and that could take years. I don't know exactly how that's going to come out. But really, it's starting the debate over again and bringing it back to the forefront of Americans' minds about gun control. Because, you know, we haven't gone a week in years without some kind of mass shooting across America. And that's important to note.
Hmm. Salt Lake Tribune Washington correspondent Thomas Burr, you're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW Salt Lake City throughout the state on Utah Public Radio. We need to take a break. We'll be right back.
Imagine you could see the unseeable.
I'm just imagining, like,
imagine you woke up and your body was a cockroach.
I'm Elise Spiegel.
And I'm Lulu Miller. And we'd like to introduce you to Invisibilia, a show about the invisible forces that shape human behavior.
Like fear.
And thoughts.
They're just synapses popping off in our head.
Join us for Invisibilia.
Careful out there in the light.
Join us for Invisibilia. Friday mornings at 10 and Saturday afternoons at 3 through February 6th, right here on Utah Public Radio.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and Logan Regional Hospital Nutrition Services, helping people live a healthier life through programs directed to prevent diabetes and heart disease. Information at loganregional.org.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with Peggy Fletcher-Stack, Christopher Smart, and Emma Penrod. And on the line, Thomas Burr, all of the Salt Lake Tribune. We're talking about the top stories of the week. And again, you are very welcome to join us. 801-355-TALK is that number. Despite the snow this morning, inversion season is upon us. And Emma, you did a piece about what happens physiologically when you're exercising outside during the inversion. What happens to a body who's breathing in this dirty air while exercising?
Well, the thing to understand about exercise and air pollution is that when you're exercising, you increase your metabolic rate. Your heart is beating faster, you're breathing faster, you're bringing more oxygen into your body. That's why you lose weight when you exercise. But it also means that you get a bigger dose of whatever's in the air that day, which means if there's pollution in the air that may be harmful, you're getting more of that than if you were just, say, walking to your car. With that in mind, what happens when you're exposed to PM2.5 is that these are these little tiny particles that they get into your lungs and they go really deep into your lungs and they cause your lungs to start swelling up like if you were rubbing sandpaper on your skin. Do that long enough and your skin will not be very happy. But that's what happens in your lungs when you have PM2.5. This results over time immediately it results in some lung damage, so to speak. You know, you get basically, you know, a burn on your lungs, and then it heals, ideally. If you get exposed to this chronically, frequently enough, your lungs can't heal right, and you may develop something like asthma or other chronic conditions. There's also increased risk of things like heart attack, stroke, and for pregnant women, premature birth.
That was the one stat that stood out to me from your story. The risk of a heart attack goes up like 14%. With exposure to this PM2.5. That's a little startling.
Well, the rule of thumb that I was told by one doctor was that it goes up 4% for every 10 micrograms per cubic meter of PM2.5 in the air. PM2.5 is calculated according to concentration, you know, how much of it is in a certain space. So for every 10 micrograms in the space that you're in, it increases your risk increases 4%. It's 14% on when we exceed the EPA's federal health standard.
And the other thing that struck me from your story was even though the dirty air is outside, the inside air is also affected. If you're working out at the pool, you're still breathing in some pollution.
Yes, and some of that is probably, you know, air coming in, but it's also in the case of a swimming pool, there's chemicals in the water, you know, that keep the pool clean that actually ultimately create PM2.5 in the building. If the building isn't properly ventilated, that's going to result in potentially an even greater concentration than you might see outdoors because it's a smaller space, so the concentration builds faster. One of the researchers I spoke to said that they found increased rates of asthma were actually highest in swimmers and ice skaters because of their chronic exposure to poorly ventilated indoor environments.
If you haven't read the story, check it out, sltrib.com. Another piece you did, the Department of Environmental Quality is launching a public relations campaign about air quality. What's the message?
Well, their public relations campaign is actually primarily about their own division. What they want people to know is what they do. They feel like the average Utahn may not be familiar with their work and with their job and what they're trying to accomplish for Utahns. And they're hoping that if they can educate people more on the role that the Department of Environmental Quality plays in their life, that people will maybe feel more support for that department, which may then influence some lawmakers this year.
Okay. Finally, you reported a little bit on technology coming out of Utah State University about how we predict inversions. Mm-hmm. And this is much more detailed and specific and longer, right? A longer time period when we can actually see the inversions coming our way.
Yeah, it's specific in that it only looks at inversions. We already, you know, we see from the Division of Air Quality probably every day, all of us, the 3-day forecast for what our air quality will look like, whether it will be a green day, a yellow day, a red day. But this only looks at, will there be an inversion, yes or no? Now, when we talk about inversions in Utah, I think sometimes we say, oh, you look outside and you see that it's, you know, the air's not so great and you think, oh, it's an inversion. Well, the inversion itself isn't the air pollution. The inversion is an atmospheric phenomenon that basically puts a lid on our valley. So again, that the concentration of pollutants in our air can build even faster than it would normally because the pollutants have nowhere to go. So this tool looks just at whether we're going to have an inversion. It doesn't try to calculate what the air quality will be, just if there's going to be an inversion overhead. And because it does that, it's able to look at this 30 days in advance instead of 3 days in advance.
Hmm. So I suppose if Salt Lake City Mayor Jackie Biskupski had the warning for 30 days, she may not have held her inauguration outside. Perhaps that's not true. I don't know. Christopher Smart, Salt Lake City did install its first gay mayor this week. Biskupski took the oath of office. What was the scene outside of City Hall? Who was there? What was the mood?
It was cold and polluted. The metal chairs were especially cold, but it was an atmosphere of, you know, joy and anticipation. There was a crowd of about 500 people, including Congresswoman Mia Love, and that was a surprise to see her. And it was just a great day, I think, for democracy, as three new council members were sworn in, including Derek Kitchen, who made a fine speech and then kissed his husband. The Calvary Baptist Choir sang, and it was really a nice ceremony. And of course, in her speech, the mayor outlined some things that she had promised to do.
Including air quality.
And what she had said in her campaign, and I think this was notable because the Utah legislature has not been at the forefront of clean air. In fact, many things that Salt Lake City has tried to do, the legislature has tried to undo, including Salt Lake City's no idling ordinance, for example. But what Jackie Biskupski said in her campaign was that she would coordinate with all the municipal governments along the Wasatch Front to see if they could all work together on this problem because, you know, the legislature just isn't doing it. You know, and there are a lot of things like building codes, for example. A lot of pollution comes from our buildings. It can really be reduced, but it costs more. And so those building codes are set by the legislature, and they're just not they don't want to do it. It's too expensive for some of their constituents. And so they're just not there. So that's a big thing that she says she's going to tackle. Another big one is affordable housing. We've got a housing boom going on in apartment complexes in Sugar House and downtown, particularly along the 4th South Corridor. Many of them don't have affordable housing units. Some do, but affordable housing is defined for right now as $750 to $800 for a one-bedroom apartment. Many people just can't afford that. So she, Jackie Biskupski, has promised what she calls a real affordable housing program. So we'll have to see what happens there. Something new, though, that she mentioned in her speech was this thing that she called a tech corridor. And so what we've seen is the high-tech companies are locating in Utah County. And Draper, of course, wants to, when the prison is gone, they want to have a high-tech campus down there. So Biskupski says that Salt Lake City is missing out on this, and she wants to form this high-tech corridor, which right now is very short on specifics. It's probably a good idea for Salt Lake City. You know, the University of Utah is churning out all of these great students in this area, and very few of them are staying in Salt Lake City. And so she wants to create a new, you know, some new opportunities there. And that is, you know, that's where we're all headed. So Salt Lake City really needs to get on the bandwagon with that. She also promised to fix our roads and our parks. And our roads need fixing really bad. But I think the one, and she's appointed some pretty smart people this week to fill positions.
Some familiar faces.
Including, former Representative Jen Selig, who was a Democratic leader in the House and was very good at working across party lines to get stuff done. She appointed Holly Mullen as Deputy Communications Director. Holly Mullen is a former colleague of ours and has been in journalism for 30 years. Lately, she's been the executive director of the Rape Recovery Center. And so, you know, Jackie Biskupski is slowly but surely filling in various spots with what looks to be very bright, capable people. But the one position I think that's going to be key is going to be the Director of Community and Economic Development. That department has languished. Several years ago, former Mayor Becker brought in a director, Eric Shaw, who really didn't work out. And in fact, not only did he not work out, but the departments under him were thrown into disarray, and then one day he just disappeared, leading us to think that he was fired. And then immediately Becker did not reappoint anybody for that until he announced his run for a third term, when he brought Jill Love, former city councilwoman, in, and she worked hard to fix that place up, but it's really the key to most things that go on in Salt Lake City.
And we don't know who Mayor Biskupski has in mind for that position yet.
Not yet.
Okay, something to watch. One other thing you reported this week, the Salt Lake City Council met for the first time with these two new members.
Right.
They elected a new chair.
Right.
Any sense of what the chemistry is going to be between this council and Mayor Biskupski?
Okay, so there's going to be a brand new dynamic because Luke Garrett and Kyle Amalfa have gone. They were two of the most dynamic members of the council and left-leaners. They have been replaced by Derek Kitchen for Luke Garrett's seat and Andrew Johnston for Kyle Amalfa's seat. Both very bright guys. Kitchen is a fiscal conservative. He's a businessman. Johnston is more involved in social work. So he's going to be, you know, more progressive in that area. But I think the real tilt that I see is going to be the emergence of James Rogers as sort of a new powerhouse. He's in his third year. He's from Rose Park. He's now the chairman, and he will set the agenda. So that's a whole new dynamic among the council, and then so you've got that with a whole new administration. I think everybody wants to work together. I think they have common goals, one of which is housing. But it'll hinge largely, I think, on how the administration fosters the relationship with the council, whether they appear to be top down or whether they can, you know, sort of work with the council on more of a partnership basis. We'll just have to wait and see.
Certainly will keep you very busy in these early days. Let's move on to another story. Tommy, you're reporting that Utah Governor Gary Herbert is in Washington. He is now the president of the National Governors Association, and he gave his State of the States address. What did he say?
He's a chair of the NGA, and so he's been back here a few times. He actually came back yesterday, met with some White House officials. He met with Speaker Paul Ryan and some congressional leaders. And then he came to the press club with his vice chair, Terry McCullough from Virginia. And they talked about some things that I think are very common themes in what Herbert talks about when he says anything about the NGA, which is that the government needs to pay attention to the states more, that there's 50 states out there that are kind of the laboratories where you can try different ideas, and everyone is different, and everyone has different regional and local needs and interests, and that he really wants to urge presidential candidates to pay attention to what the states need and what they're doing. He cited a few examples. For example, he said the religious freedom law that he signed into office in Utah that was backed by the LDS Church was a good example of what you could do if Congress would just stop bickering all the time. There are things that can be done where you can find common ground, and that's happening in the states because the states don't get the option of shutting things down or stopping and blocking legislation forever. They have to get things done so that constituents notice. So essentially, it's just the typical thing that Herbert pushes, and this was his state of the state saying, hey, look at us, pay attention.
Well, how receptive is Congress? How receptive will the president be to what the states have to say?
In some ways, and this is Terry, Terry McCullough pointed out that Congress actually did do several things last year that states wanted. For example, the highway bill. They finally passed this long-term funding for highway bill that's been languishing forever. I'm sure there are some governors out there pretty happy with the president's actions on gun control. Others not so happy, of course. But really, we have to look at this year as this kind of a lost year because Congress really isn't going to do much. The president's lame duck now, and everyone's going to be focused on Hillary and Bernie and Trump and Carson and Cruz and all these other guys versus what's actually going on in Washington.
You reported this week, speaking of the presidential campaign, you reported that Representative Jason Chaffetz has come out in support of Marco Rubio. Why does he like this candidate?
Chaffetz actually has been kind of holding steady for a while, not sure which one he's going to back. And he came out this week, and actually I believe today he's actually in New Hampshire, and tomorrow he's going to be in South Carolina stumping for Marco Rubio. And Chaffetz came together with Rubio, put out a statement. He matches that endorsement with the rest of Utah's delegation. Mia Love, Chris Stewart have both as well backed Marco Rubio. And, of course, and thing we know, Senator Orrin Hatch is backing Jeb Bush, so that leaves only Senator Mike Lee, who hasn't endorsed anyone, and he may not endorse anyone for fear of kicking off one of his good friends who's running for president right now. So he's kind of just going to stay on the sidelines for a while, it seems.
And the rumors of a Mitt Romney bid continue. How long is this going to linger?
I guess until we run out of ink. I'm really sure. It's always one of those, wow, would this race be different if Mitt Romney was in it? Because I think there are a lot of Republicans, especially establishment Republicans, are upset about this Donald guy who seems to be leading in the polls and loves his polls and talks about his polls a lot. But you have to imagine Mitt Romney's got to be sitting back saying, I'm really glad I did not get in this race right now, because could you imagine what it would be like going up against a candidate like Donald Trump?
I suppose, Peggy, that Mormons are pretty happy that Mitt Romney's not part of this circus right now.
Yeah, maybe.
Well, let's switch gears back to religion. The LDS Church announced three new missions yesterday. Peggy, give us the details.
They announced three new missions, two in Africa, and the a little bit surprising one is in Vietnam. Obviously, the church is interested in spreading its message, and a country like Vietnam is a little unusual. The church has had missionaries there for some time, like a decade or so, but they haven't really had a mission. They haven't had official proselytizing missionaries there. The church got official recognition from the government, which is, by the way, communist, in 2014 and set up its second branch. So having actual missionaries on the ground is kind of interesting and new.
Has the church ventured into communist nations before?
Ugh.
They're in Laos.
Yeah, there's
They
Cambodia,
are in Laos?
Yes.
Cambodia.
Are they in China?
No. I mean, there are members in China, but there are no, it's forbidden to proselytize there.
It's interesting. Did the church talk about the negotiations with the Vietnamese government? How did this come about?
Did the church talk about negotiations?
Okay. Maybe I'm asking.
Not to me.
Too ambitious. Well, did they say at least indicate the leadership of these new missions? Will they be recruiting locals or bringing in talent from the mothership?
Again, I think some of the leaders of the Vietnam mission may be from the U.S., but the African ones... my source, Matt Martinich, who's a terrific demographer, said he would be interested to see who the leaders they choose for the Congolese. The two African missions are in Nigeria and in the Democratic Republic of Congo, and it will be interesting to see who the leaders if they're locals, then that really says there's a lot more faith and trust in the local leadership than maybe they have in the past.
And two new African missions. What does that say about growth in the church?
Well, it definitely says the church is growing in Africa, which is a big plus for the church to say that, given its history with the race issue. And, of course, all Christians are growing in Africa. So that's not unique to Mormonism, but... It's still a good thing. I'm sure that they would see that as a sign of real growth.
Is the expansion of the missions directly related to the lowering of the eligibility ages for both men and women who want to serve missions? I mean, has that fundamentally changed the way that the church is approaching mission expansion?
I'm sure that having a dramatically increased a number of missionaries has had an impact on where they put how many missions they have. There are more than 400 missions. And I'm sure that lowering the age and going from 58,000 missionaries to 80,000 missionaries has some impact on that. But the numbers of convert baptisms hasn't really risen in a parallel way. So I'm sure, I'm guessing they are figuring all that out. There's no question that the church is growing in Africa. Not all American missionaries or families want to go to Africa, so that's a problem.
And what? Finally, the timing. So if a young person wants to serve the LDS church, could the possibility that they get their assignment in Vietnam be tomorrow?
No, this is starting. I mean, the mission will start July 1st. So I guess maybe some people could get called there. I don't know all the behind the scenes figuring out who gets sent there or what. I'm guessing that they'll rely a lot on members in those areas or people who speak Vietnamese. People have some knowledge of the culture. But again, that's just a guess. I have no idea.
Okay. Salt Lake Tribune religion writer Peggy Fletcher Stack is with us talking about the week's top stories. And again, we need to take another break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW in Salt Lake City, throughout the state on Utah Public Radio.
Tuesday night, it's an NPR News special, live coverage of President Obama's final State of the Union address. I'm Audie Cornish. Join me as we hear reaction from Congress, the official Republican response, and in-depth analysis with NPR reporters from the campaign trail in Iowa to the halls of Capitol Hill. It's special coverage of President Obama's last State of the Union address from NPR News.
Join us Tuesday night at 7 here on Utah Public Radio.
And I had enough therapy to know what was going on. Brooklyn was like my mom, warm and inviting, and Manhattan was like my dad, elusive and bipolar. Join us for more true stories told live, this time adoption, reconciliation, and faith. That's the Moth Radio Hour from PRX.
Join us Saturday night at 6 on Utah Public Radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and it's time for our final segment of the week, the underplayed story. And Emma, why don't you kick us off? What do you got?
Well, I actually saw something last night that surprised me that I hadn't seen it before, even though I guess coverage started earlier this week. Apparently, there have been some hepatitis C cases linked to a couple hospitals in Utah. And I guess they're linked to one nurse who worked at both hospitals who had the disease. And they're now asking that the patients who may have had contact with that nurse go in and be tested. They said it may be a couple years before, if they've caught it, that they before they have symptoms, they want them to go in and be tested for hepatitis C in case they caught it from their nurse.
Which hospital is this?
It was at McKay-D Hospital and Davis Hospital and Medical Center.
Oh, my goodness.
The two hospitals.
Okay, that is a good story to know. Christopher Smart, what's your pick?
This is the one-year anniversary of the shooting death of James Barker on the avenues by a Salt Lake City police officer. We haven't reported on this for a while, and it certainly nationwide is a very reported story. They're going through convulsions in Chicago right now on this that threatens the administration of Rahm Emanuel. However, in a op-ed today in the Salt Lake Tribune, former Salt Lake City Councilwoman Dita Seed says that since in the past year, really nothing has changed for the way, you know, police approach folks who they think may be breaking the law. There was also the case of Dylan Taylor, who was shot at the 7-Eleven on State Street by a Salt Lake City police officer who thought he had a gun. He didn't have a gun. James Barker was up on the avenues with a snow shovel, just looking for work, got into an argument with the police officer, and a fight ensued, and Barker was killed. But as we look across the nation, we see that police officers have the right to use deadly force anytime they think they are threatened. So that led to the shooting of the 9-year-old boy in Cleveland. He was at a park with a toy gun. He was black. The police rolled up, got out of their car and shot him dead. So this is really something that needs to be addressed. It's something that remains on the to-do list for the Salt Lake City Council. Mayor Biskupski comes from the sheriff's office, and we'll just have to see how this plays out.
Absolutely. Peggy Fletcher Stack, what's your pick?
Troubled a little bit by a story about artists on Pierpont Avenue in Salt Lake City, a longstanding sort of artisan, a lovely street for arts and artisans, and a new owner is dramatically raised the rent, causing some of them to move and some of them to go out of business. Breaks my heart.
Tommy Burr.
All right, I have two, but I'll make them quick. One's going to make you groan. Ben Carson's in Des Moines, Iowa, yesterday, and he often tells a story about how he was the worst student in school until he turned around his act, and then he became, you know, this amazing neurosurgeon. But he asked a group of fifth graders, who is the worst student in your class? And before he says, and finishes, you know, about his story, they all point to this little boy. Who later on kind of shrugged it off, and his mom's like, oh, you know, he was a little embarrassed, but it's not a big deal. I think that was a little much. So I think Ben Carson should be careful about how he asks questions of kids.
Wow.
The second story is that you in Utah probably may not be aware of this, but the Powerball is $700 million.
I've heard.
I bought a couple tickets. I just wanted to rub that in a little bit.
Thanks a lot, Tommy. Really appreciate that. Thomas Burr, Emma Penrod, Chris Smart, Peggy Fletcher Stack, all of the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks, everybody, for your time today. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thanks.
We're going to wrap up this week with Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. This week, Kirby, with all this talk of militias, he's thought about forming a militia of his own.
Well, I suppose that, you know, a militia in the sense of a National Guard or something like that is probably a good idea, but too often these, they end up being organizations that want to push their ideology off on the rest of us. And they range in terms of threat from just being annoying all the way up to the Timothy McVeighs, which, you know, blow up buildings. And I thought this was a particularly compelling thing since so many of them seem to have a religious tone to them.
You've toyed around with perhaps forming a pseudo-militia.
Oh, yeah, but, I mean, we wouldn't hurt anybody except ourselves. But, yeah, I did come up with an idea for one. Back in 2010, I decided that I was going to start this militia and call it the Noble Undercover Troopers of Zion, or NUTS. And I went through, I wrote a column about how to join it and how to form it and that sort of thing. And from that column, I've started my own Christian LDS militia, Noble Undercover Troopers of Zion. Don't tell anyone. NUTS needs to remain a secret until we strike or get arrested. We haven't figured out exactly where we'll strike. Right now we're debating, arguing really, between blowing up the U.S. House of Representatives and robbing a zoo. Both have their merits. We may be presumptuous. So far, NUTS is just Larry, Sonny, and me. However, since Larry only has a 22 and Sonny won't come to the mystery meetings, it's really just me for now. Even so, we are serious. NUTS is committed to protecting the Christian rights of God-fearing America from corrupt politicians, paperists, Muslims, jujubes, outer spatial marriage, police harassment, and, well, some other stuff. Okay, we're still forming our righteous agenda, but we'll get it down before the second coming.
Wow. Well, in a serious note, is there something that you would be willing to fight for the way that we're seeing up in Oregon?
No, actually, not really at this particular point. I mean, given if we're still talking about the state, you know, that America is in today, no, I wouldn't form a militia and guard stuff with a rifle. I did enough of that in the Army. But I can certainly understand people's concerns about things that are they feel are improper, inappropriate, or even illegal. The question is whether or not they have a right to force them onto the rest of us.
That's Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. Again, read all Kirby all the time on the archives, sltrib.com. That's it for this edition of Behind the Headlines, a production of KCPW, UPR, and the Salt Lake Tribune. A brief program note, Trib Talk Live coming to the Tower Theater Tuesday, 7 o'clock. KCPW will broadcast next Friday a rebroadcast, a recording of the event. We're talking about Sundance, so hope you can join us. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great weekend.
Hi, I'm Rachel Giza. The Gay Heritage Project is a new play that features the stories of notable and forgotten characters in queer history. Next time on Q, I'll chat with its creators about what they reveal about modern gay culture. That's coming up on Q from PRI, Public Radio International.
Coming up today at 1 here on Utah Public Radio.
This is KUSR HD1 89.5 Logan, KUSK HD1 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1 88.7 Moab, KCEU 89.7 Price, and KUSUFM HD1 91.5 Logan.